Good afternoon, Your Honors. James Hopkins representing Randall Romero, the defendant appellant. Randall Romero, a 17-year-old offender, did not get a fair trial. The remedy for this is a 35C hearing. Here's why. There's five reasons. First reason that Randall Romero gets a 35C hearing is that during trial, Randall's trial judge interfered with his ability to affect the composition of the jury. That happened because he didn't get all the peremptory challenges. And a hearing is necessary on that issue because it could not be dealt with on appeal. If it was raised on appeal, the record at the time of direct appeal did not exist to determine a couple things. The first thing related specifically to the peremptory challenge issue is whether or not prejudice existed in that the composition of the jury was impacted by the trial court's interference. We just don't have that information. And that is very well suited to the 35C hearing.
You don't have the prejudice information?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Hopkins, you don't need prejudice on direct appeal when there's been a failure to grant the proper number of peremptory challenges, do you? Isn't it an automatic reversal rule?
That's correct, Your Honor. In Colorado, unlike the federal rule, which is if there's no foul, if there's no harm, there's no foul, Colorado assumes that if there is a foul, there is harm. However, regardless of it being clear reversal, it would still need to be shown, and it would be helpful to any court, whether it was an appellate court or a 35C judge, to know if that in fact was a strategy decision by the trial attorney. And that kind of ties into the second reason that Randall should get a 35C hearing, but I'll get to that in a second. That information is impossible to know without testimony from the trial attorney, which could happen in a 35C hearing. And that would certainly be something that was raised if this were up on direct appeal. And part of the challenge that the initial direct appeal lawyer, who was also the post-conviction lawyer, faced was, how do I best convince the court that this hurt my client? And they chose to push it back to the 35C phase of the case. Your Honor is correct that it's possible Mr. Randall could have won that on direct appeal, could have. It's not a guarantee. And the appellate lawyer was looking at that saying, well, I can show how this impacted the composition of the jury and hurt my client. And that makes it a stronger argument. It's also a dual nature issue. It's not only a peremptory challenge issue, it's an issue of effectiveness of counsel, because they could have raised that, or that the trial counsel should have objected at the time that happened to preserve it for appeal. And they did not. So they were facing that hurdle, even if it's a clear error issue, that it was not preserved.
Is there an exception to the provision in Crimpy 35C37 that says if it could have been raised on appeal, you had to have raised it then or forfeited?
That is part of Rule 35. But the very next section of Rule 35 also says if this is a constitutional issue relating to effectiveness of counsel, it is preferred that it is raised in a 35C venue, and it is not covered by the preceding portion of the rule.
So your ineffectiveness claim wouldn't be barred by Crimpy 35C37, but what about the due process argument?
And I want to be cautious about how I answer. I do not reach the same conclusion Your Honor does. Raising that issue in the appeal, I believe that was part of the problem that the appellate slash post-conviction lawyer was facing. They were also concerned that if they raised it on appeal and lost, it would be considered exhausted in a 35C hearing, because it appears to be the same issue, although it's a little more intricate than that. There is effectiveness of counsel issues mixed in with it, and that is in fact the second reason that Randall should get a 35C hearing. His lawyer was ineffective for not preserving the peremptory challenge issue for appeal, and ineffective for not making sure his client was protected by being able to use the peremptory challenges that he had coming, which were 12 instead of the 10 that he got. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure if I answered the next question you were moving to.
No, you did. Thank you.
Thank you. So that would be the second reason Randall should get a 35C hearing. The third reason that Randall should get a 35C hearing is that trial counsel was ineffective regarding how they handled the jury instructions. Specifically, they failed to request a theory of the defense instruction. And in a capital case, that's a monumental mistake. Second, they failed to present evidence or request a lesser included instruction. And that is exacerbated by another reason that Randall should get a 35C hearing that I'm about to get to, but the jury basically had one option when it came to what Randall could be convicted of. It was either not guilty or capital murder. And there was a lot of evidence that was not reviewed by the trial lawyer that was mitigating.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't second degree murder instructed on?
I think second degree murder might have been instructed, Your Honor. I think there specifically there was a lesser included as an accessory that was not instructed on. And that specifically, right, yes. And that's specifically another lesser that could have been provided. And one of the reasons that's so important is because of the mitigating information, that could have drawn significant attention from the jury, because the mitigating information that was left out. And I'm now getting into the fourth reason Randall should get a 35C hearing. His trial lawyer, dealing with a child offender, had information that needed to be investigated. He had reason to believe that Randall might have suffered a severe beating that might have resulted in frontal lobe trauma. He had reason to think that Randall was low functioning, and just based on his interactions with Randall. He had access to Randall's school records because the public defender had initially had the case and had been transferred to private counsel. Never looked at the school records. These are all allegations that were made in Randall's 35C motion. Now, the rule for getting a 35C motion is really straightforward. You need allegations of fact, just allegations that are not disproven by the record. That's the second prong. And that provides some basis for relief, some kind of remedy. We have that on every one of the arguments raised by Randall Romero in his 35C motion. The fifth reason, and we don't need to spend much time on this, that was raised in 35C motion, was cumulative prejudice. If the trial court did not find one of these was prejudicial enough, there was certainly a mountain of prejudice hurting Randall at trial because of each of these mistakes of his trial lawyer. But focusing on the standard for a 35C hearing, first you look and you see, do we have facts? Do we have facts that were raised that create questions that are unanswered by the record? So if the record does not disprove those facts or sort out those questions that have been raised by those factual allegations, and there's some kind of remedy, and there's a remedy for each and every one of these 35C arguments. The remedy is a new trial. And we don't have any of these facts disproven on the record. There's not a single allegation raised in Randall's 35C motion that is disproven by the record, not one. So that leaves us with, is there a remedy? We have a remedy. So on each one of the 35C issues raised, Randall should get a 35C hearing. Now, the trial court's order is telling. If you look at the trial court's order, and that was on a couple different pages in the record, but in volume 1, page 280, and also pages 281 through 282 of the same order, the trial court talks about what the trial court perceives as the standard for a hearing. And with all due respect to the trial court, they are dead wrong. They say here that because the allegations are conclusory, they cannot require a hearing. They say, and I quote, before a hearing can be granted, the exculpatory evidence must be identified and it must be shown that it was of sufficient weight to have resulted in a different outcome. Now, that may be the standard for ruling on a 35C issue following a hearing, but it is not the standard for whether you get a hearing. The trial court does not cite to any statutory or case law authority when it makes those assertions. And what we're left with here is a trial court that simply got it wrong. Randall should have gotten a hearing on each of these issues. Regarding some of the failure to investigate facts, a point that I want to make to the court is that aside from this being significant charge situation for Randall, his lawyer was dealing with an adolescent, however you want to describe Randall at the time. He was 17 when he was charged with crime. A child who the lawyer had information might be low functioning, might have brain trauma, and none of that was investigated. It's bad enough that it was not investigated for purposes of sentencing, although in Randall's case, at that point, the court has almost no discretion. And that brings us back to trial, because the trial lawyer knew that. And although they had second degree, and they should have had another lesser, it makes it all the more important for that trial lawyer to know exactly what his client's capabilities were, his ability to perform some kind of crime knowingly, and present that information to the jury. And it didn't happen, because the trial lawyer didn't have the information, because they didn't investigate. And that is patently ineffective. The question of whether or not it calls for prejudice, that's for the trial court to decide at a 35C hearing. And if your honors don't have any more questions, I will reserve for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Clark again, John Lee, Matt Feeble, by number 38141. On peremptory claim, as outlined in the briefs, the defendant's argument requires this court to take three steps. One, that his claim was properly brought on post-conviction. Two, that it asserts a constitutional claim. And then three, it's such a claim that actually required reversal. Beginning with the first, as this court has pointed out, the due process peremptory challenge claim should have been brought on direct appeal. The claim, as it's argued in the briefs, and I think to a large extent today, is based on the record exactly as was provided on direct appeal. It's that he didn't get the number of peremptories he was afforded to by law. Nothing about that claim at all hinges on his right to counsel. It should have been brought on direct appeal, and it, as the trial court found, it could not and was not properly brought on in a post-conviction proceeding.
The argument on the constitutionality, or the constitution issue, if you will, is that this is a due process violation because the defendant didn't get what the state law requires that he get. How do you respond to that?
Well, what I respond to that is it's barred by post-conviction motion. By not raising direct appeal, the defendant waived the claim. Under the plain terms of Crimpy 35C, you can raise a claim that you could have raised in direct appeal. And again, nothing at all about the due process claim hinges on the record different than what we have in direct appeal. Even the cases the defendant cited are Leo and Thomas, which explain why we have this exception, T35C, for ineffective assistance of counsel claims. It's again that same reason. Even if something appears to be deficient performance, there might be a good reason why, so we want to get an additional record. And just in the context of judicial economy, we want that after direct appeal, because we don't want to create that additional record until we know that we need it, because the conviction might be reversed otherwise direct appeal. Looking at those two rationales, those have all been applied to what we have here. we don't need additional record. His claim is squarely focused on what happened upon, or what was in the trial record, and should have been brought on direct appeal. In regards to the question of whether or not this does constitute a reversible constitutional error, the people strongly disagree that it does. Whenever we're dealing with reversible error, the focus is always which right does it violate and how did it affect the defendant's right to a fair trial. Nothing about reducing peremptory challenges equally to both sides in any way undermines the fairness or integrity of the trial. The U.S. Supreme Court in Ross expressly found that the right to peremptory challenges is not constitutional. As we outlined in the briefs, to constitutionalize the rule would be to say the legislature can never change the amount of peremptory challenges given, which we know isn't the case because the legislature already affords different peremptory challenges for the different category of crime a person is charged with. The criminal rule itself allows the court to grant more peremptory challenges for good cause shown to just one side or the other. And so I think, although I will acknowledge that the current state of Colorado law does acknowledge that there is due process violation when one side, and I really do think this was the key to Lefebvre, when one side is given, in effect, and in fact, the opportunity to shape the jury more than the other, that creates due process violation. But again, that is not at all comparable to what we have here when the error affects both sides equally. Neither side was given initial challenge or opportunity to, in fact, shape the jury more than the other. Both sides were given 10. So under that, there's no violation of due process or the defendant's right to impartial jury. There's been no claim that the 12 jurors who sat were not fair and impartial jurors. So the six-member jury right, I think that's completely out of this case.
I thought there was a claim, perhaps in the context of ineffective assistance, Mr. Lee, that one of the jurors who actually sat was biased. Wasn't there an affidavit from the criminal defense expert proffered that said something to that effect?
Your Honor, I don't remember there being one. I will say that on page 25 of the opening brief, the defendant outlines his different claims for why the court should have, or for what he alleged and why the court should have granted it, and that's not included within those claims. The only allegations listed in the opening brief were that the defendant argued below that he would present an expert who would show that he was prejudiced, and that the trial court should have, he could have changed the composition of the jury, not that one of the jurors was biased. But again, to the extent that was the claim, that's direct appeal. And we're not in direct appeal, so that would also be barred, given the procedure that we're currently in.
But Mr. Lee, if we assume for purposes of this argument that it was ineffective performance to not request the full amount of peremptories, what then should the rule be on how much you have to show to get a hearing on prejudice? If they've alleged, and I think somewhere, maybe it was in 35C, they said, we can show that one of the jurors was biased. Is that enough for a hearing?
It's not. A bare assertion of what someone can do does not create a sufficient fact to establish for the court to find that if you prove a fact that it would in fact, I guess I'm doing the same thing, that, I mean, it's too attenuated. You have to say a fact, if true, that would establish a legal principle, not that you could present evidence. So for example, I couldn't say in a post-conviction motion, if I get a hearing, I will have someone testify that I would. That would not be sufficient basis, because the trial court can't review that. What it needs to be is a tangible fact for the court to be able to look at it and determine whether it's either refuted by the record or whether or not it's foreclosed by the law before we give you a hearing, which is really the whole point of the pleading requirements we have in 35C, is that that there are enough facts in there that the trial court can go ahead and make its initial showing and go ahead and kind of filter through and triage out what does and does not merit a hearing. And the bold conclusion of, I can have someone testify that I win, is not sufficient. I mean, that doesn't help us triage out the cases that do and do not deserve a 35C hearing. The court has no further questions on the peremptory challenge under to the other claims the defendant raised today. So I think that gets rid of the first and seconds. The third claim the defense raised was his counsel was ineffective in not providing correct instructions. I think this court has already explained. The claim that trial counsel should have asked for a lesser included defense, as the trial court found, was flatly refuted by the record. He did ask for a lesser included defense, second degree murder. The jury rejected it. I think as a matter of law, that he can either show prejudice nor deficient performance on that ground. With respect to the trial counsel should have done additional investigation because the defendant he was aware the defendant had been previously hit in the head. Again, much like the ineffective counsel on the appropriate challenge claim, there weren't sufficient facts pled for that to merit a hearing. Just saying that it's possible, or that I was hit in the head, so counsel should have investigated, without an allegation that it did impair his mental capacity, and an explanation for how that would have changed the outcome of the trial, that doesn't articulate a sufficient basis for a 35C hearing on its own terms. And on the fifth claim, that just leaves us with cumulative error, because all four of the previous claims are not error, and obviously there is no cumulative error, as there is no single error.
I want to take you back to the challenge issue in the context of ineffective assistance.
Sure.
One of the claims the defendant has made is that failure of counsel to preserve the issue in the trial court prevented him from winning on appeal because he would have had to raise it under plain error if he raised it at all. What's your response to that?
Well, my response is it wouldn't be reversible. He could have raised it under plain error. And I guess under existing Colorado Court of Appeals case law, which I would disagree with, but he could have won on that.
He could have won on a plain error review?
A ban on the defendant, yes. So again, it did not at all turn and was improperly brought in post-conviction. So there is an issue when a defense attorney does not fully exhaust his peremptory challenges, then you have to exhaust them all to preserve it, but when the trial court doesn't give it to you, you don't have to do anything further to preserve the claim that you didn't get as many as you're entitled to. You can still raise it on plain error review. So it's certainly not an issue of a claim of waiver. Although I will say that, to the extent that it would be a review of plain error, we would say that it was not reversible.
All right, if you were to assume that defendant were entitled to a hearing on his claim for ineffectiveness of counsel in the peremptory challenge context, what prejudice, if any, I mean, what is the prejudice that has to be shown, in your view?
I think under the law's view, he would have to show that the outcome of proceedings would have been different. And I don't think that's a burden he could carry, and I certainly don't think it is something he sufficiently alleged in order to prove that burden. Because again, when we're dealing with a claim of it affected both sides equally, even if he could have changed two jurors, so could the people. And merely changing, if everyone is fair to begin with, and there's no dispute, and I don't know if there is or not, but under my understanding, there's not a dispute that the jurors were fair, then the defendant can't show the outcome proceeds would have been different. I'm having a hard time finding how. I'm having a hard time thinking how he could.
From a factual standpoint, you can't conceive of how that could be proved.
I guess he could show that he could show the two he would have excused, the two who would have come in, and I guess they do this in other states where it's not reversible error or it's not structural error, and then argue that that would have changed the outcome of the proceedings. So that's what we have to prove.
And isn't that a factual issue?
It would be a factual issue, yes. But I don't think that necessarily means that he's entitled to it, because I don't think, as alleged, he presented sufficient facts to justify. I think you have to explain, or at least allege, provide some basis for the court to find that you would be able to prove that the outcomes of proceedings would have been different. It's not enough that I had 12 fair jurors, I would have added two other fair jurors instead of those two fair jurors, and the result of the proceedings would have been different. So under that, we would still marry the defense on titles for hearing on this matter. If the court has no further questions, I should confirm the order of court below. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Your Honor, the AG's making a tenuous argument about the issue of saving the peremptory challenge argument either for direct appeal or the 35C. One, they're saying, yes, you win it if you raise it on direct appeal, or you could. Then they're saying, but actually, you have to show all this other stuff, so it creates a factual issue. I mean, the court has to pick one here. And Rule 35C provides the guidance. As the AG argued, Rule 35C has a clear rule about exhaustion. It says you better raise it or you're going to lose it. It then also says if it involves ineffective assistance of counsel, we prefer it is saved, and it is not exhausted if you save it for a 35C. So the preference under the rules and under Colorado case law, when there's an issue of ineffectiveness, the purpose of your lawyer is to try to put you in the best position to win. They can show prejudice better if it's raised in 35C. And that's why, as a lawyer, looking at that as a direct appeal, even though you have a pretty good error standard versus 35C, you take the 35C, you show prejudice if you can, and you say, hey, look, you've also got a good standard. We need a new trial. That's exactly how a smart lawyer should handle that situation. That's exactly how Randall's lawyer handled it. But then he was robbed of that argument, even though his lawyer was trying to use what I think was strong strategy.
The argument is made, Mr. Hopkins, that there were insufficient facts alleged to be able to prove any prejudice under these circumstances. What's your response to that?
Well, there are certainly allegations, and again, that's what the 35C hearing is for. The allegations were, and I want to be clear, that they were not that, as the court was recollecting, that there was a biased juror. The allegations were that they would present evidence about the jurors they would remove and why. So maybe there's an inference that they felt they were biased jurors, at least from a peremptory challenge standpoint, maybe not for cause. And then they would show information about why that changed the composition of the jury. And I mean, I think that's as easy as comparing the jurors you would have versus the jurors you would get.
But what about Mr. Lee's point that you have 12 fair jurors and you substitute two of them with two other fair jurors? How does that show prejudice? I mean, he may have been denied the opportunity to shape the jury, but if in fact the people that actually decided the case were fair and impartial, and the prosecution would have been able to exercise two more challenges as well, how do you go about proving?
Well, the other thing that would be facing the trial court in a 35C setting on the issue would not just be, we have to be careful how we use the term prejudice, because like we talked about earlier, the rule in Colorado is not necessarily equate to prejudice. It equates to the defendant's ability to impact the composition of the jury was interfered with by the trial court, and that's exactly what we have here. The record is very clear that the trial court planned on having 12, everybody agreed to it. It was then forgotten. By the time we got to 10, the trial court reminded each of the lawyers with 10 instead of 12. Didn't occur to either of the trial lawyers. Mr. Romero's lawyer should have objected. And at a minimum, we're talking about one, two jurors difference if Randall's exercising his peremptory challenges. The DA may have exercised peremptory challenges also. Now, that isn't up to Randall, but it certainly impacts the composition even more. So we're not talking about good or bad on the composition, we're talking about whether the composition of the jury changes when the defendant wanted it to.
Well, your argument then, as I understand it, assumes that if you can show the jury would have changed, that's enough to prove prejudice.
What I understand
Mr. Lee to be saying is, you have to show the outcome of the trial would have been different, a reasonable probability.
No, that is incorrect. Because Colorado is not no harm, no foul. Colorado is, if there's a foul, we assume harm. That's the rule in Colorado. And if the court looks at the McCrander case in footnote 12, it gives a good synopsis of how Colorado differs from the federal interpretation of peremptory challenges and how the remedies will be doled out for those.
But McCrander was a direct appeal case, not a 35C case.
I agree with that, Aaron, but that does not change how the trial court would have to address this issue. What we're missing on the direct appeal is the ability of the trial court to hear information about whether or not the composition would have changed at all. They don't have to prove that it would have changed in a harmful or advantageous way. All that has to happen is the trial lawyer walks into court and testifies, I forgot I would have used them. That's it. Composition changed.
But aren't you reading out the second prong of Strickland for a 35C then?
Well, and again, remember, this peremptory challenge issue is kind of intermingled. And what I argued and what was raised in the 35C motion is, one, the issue on its own requires a new trial. Two, trial lawyer was ineffective for not objecting and for not using the peremptory challenges to impact. So you'd have to apply Strickland to the trial lawyer's behavior, but what the 35C motion, what I'm arguing today, is that first, you can grant a new trial and not even get to the other 35C issues just based on the fact that the composition of the jury would have been different if the peremptories were used, and the trial court stopped that from happening by not allowing the 12 challenges, and not reminding the lawyers directly. Thank you for the extra questions, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will also stand submitted, and we will issue a written opinion in due course.